Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger. In the heartland, in the bunker. Right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world and all the ships at sea. And all the satellites up in the sky, baby. Yeah, we got the wolf calls going. Have you heard the wolf call in your community? If you have a CB radio, we'll put the wolf call on. Let's get them howling everywhere around the country on Channel 5. Yeah, right, yeah. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And address your mail to occupant, box holder, Tom Metzger, insurgent, or whatever yanks your crank, baby. Yeah.
Yes, and we are at P.O. Box 401 here in Warsaw, Indiana, on a very snowy day. And this is the 27th of February, getting down close to March. So if you're going to get it done, if you're going to change the world in February, you better get at it, because you're running out of time. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Yeah, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Our big website is resist.com. And if you'd like to reach me or talk to me, 574-267-5036. And if I'm in the bunker, usually between about 10 in the morning to about 2 or so in the afternoon, sometimes I'm around here doing a lot of other stuff. But anyhow, and you can go to that or go to 559-670-1473. I got a brand new message up there. Brand new message for you. That's right. Well, boys and girls, let's go back to DC Scout. He sent me three or four shows here, so it's time to get back to DC Scout and see what the hell he got to report from the eye of the storm, from the center of the corruption, from La Cesspool Grande. Here we go.
Hello, resistors. This is DC Scout reporting to you from the cloaca of Washington, D.C., on January the 20th, 2014. I'm going to read you a rather long article from the January 12th issue of the China Daily, which is published by the Washington Post Company, I believe, which was recently purchased by the crypto Jew Jeff Bezos, the so-called founder and owner of Amazon.com. The title of this article is Why Black-Asian Tensions Persist. In photos of the moments after Malcolm X was fatally shot at Manhattan's Audubon Ballroom in 1965, a bespectacled Asian woman cradles his head. That woman was Yuri Kochiyama, an ally and one of the godparents of the Asian American activism movement. Like other Asian Americans who had previously joined the Black Panthers, she drew inspiration and support from the rise of civil rights activism among African Americans. That same year, a change in U.S. immigration policy radically changed the demography of Asian America, attracting large numbers of educated, skilled Chinese workers that set the stage for a 1966 U.S. News and World Report article that heralded the achievements of a model minority, pitting Asian American success against the continued agitating of African Americans. And let me interject here that Malcolm X was a black nationalist, and when he started to slip out of control of his Jews' handlers, the Jews egged on one of Malcolm X's natural rivals who killed him. Continuing with the article. At a time when it is being proposed that hundreds of billions be spent to uplift Negroes and other minorities, the nation's 300,000 Chinese Americans are moving ahead on their own, the article charged. And that's the article from the U.S. News and World Report in 66. In the years since, the conception of a model minority has insidiously driven a wedge between the African American and Asian American communities, as evidenced most recently in the backlash against Asian American activist Suey Park's efforts to promote a Twitter discussion about discrimination against Asian American women in December. In response to Park's "Not Your Asian Sidekick" tweets, which spurred a conversation of more than 60,000 percipients, etc., etc., Asian privilege, this is quoting, Asian privilege means being overrepresented at universities when changing the narrative to make it look like you are oppressed. Asian privilege is Indians in an African country like Uganda controlling the entire nation's economy while majority blacks were in poverty. Others argued that as a large percentage of the global population, Asian Americans shouldn't claim to understand the minority experience. And it goes on, quoting the back and forth between Negroes and Asians on this Twitter shit. Continuing, when America writes off black success as a result of affirmative action and Asian success as just being model minority. The discussion on this is long overdue, Park told China Daily. Quote, Asian Americans and African Americans have often internalized the idea of limited resources. Note this, particularly among low-income and older generations, she said. Fighting for your seat at the table can be a survival tactic among minorities. The question now is, how can we create a space for both Asian Americans and Black Americans to talk without shaming each other of being unknowledgeable about the other's experiences? Everyone is most knowledgeable about their own experience, and a discussion in which African Americans raise questions about whether Asian privilege exists is important too. End quote. So again, the white man's pie is dwindling. And Asians have the upper hand because they're more intelligent and they're more industrious, and above all because their women are more attractive. And white men go after Asian women far, far more often than they go after black women. The women are always a wedge for entry into the ruling classes. And the Jews have long understood this. Continue with the article. A history of conflict. The tension displayed on Twitter is no surprise to those who remember the 1992 Los Angeles riots, in which anger in the African American community following a not guilty verdict on Rodney King spilled over into violence toward the Korean American shopkeepers. Also contributing to existing tensions was the death of a 15-year-old African-American girl, Latasha Harlins, who was shot by a Korean store owner who assumed she was stealing orange juice. In the poor neighborhoods where African-Americans had often been denied small business loans, I interject here, because niggers can't run a store, Asian-American shop owners were collectively viewed as mistrustful of African-Americans, but more than willing to take their money. Continuing, in 2010, a string of highly publicized crimes perpetrated by African-American teenagers against elderly Asian-American men and women in Berkeley, California, and Brooklyn, New York, spurred fresh discussions of the conflict. That spring, an 83-year-old Chinese man was beaten to death by five black teenagers. Well, ain't that just beautiful? And a 59-year-old Chinese woman sustained injuries when she was pushed off a subway platform. And a 59-year-old Chinese man died after being assaulted by two teenagers. I interject here. Listen, 59 is not old. 59 years old is not old. You can kick ass at 59 years old. And if you ain't physically strong enough, you can carry a blade or a pistol or even some knuckles or a rock in your pocket. This stereotyping of 60-year-olds and 70-year-olds as being frail and needing special protection is bullshit. Continuing with the article. We don't want to escalate with African Americans, so we don't say it, said an Asian. But it is racial, that's a fact. Continuing with the article. The belief that darker skin is less valuable is prevalent in Asia, but not uniquely Asian, said Natasha Tamar Sharma, professor in African American and Asian Studies at Northwestern University. And there's a plug-in by the Jews. Much of that belief is related to the history of Western colonization and class connotations tied to whether or not a group of people has been forced to labor outdoors, she said. Once again, skin color doesn't correlate with anything. Skin color does not correlate with behavior. Continuing to quote the professor, those beliefs are already ingrained, and then for immigrants who arrive in America and are bombarded with anti-black images, being racist against black people can subconsciously feel like a way to be American. And unfortunately, it kind of is, she said, unquote. I don't know what this Negro college professor is talking about. You go on TV, and the niggers seem to be on top to me. They absolutely dominate the social situations, not only Jew-controlled corporate sports, but in every kind of serial thriller or detective show. You'll see the white detectives are inept, and then Washington's going to send in the big nigger from D.C. to handle the situation. So this is more, this article is more deception and diversion. Continuing with the article. The instances of overt violence between the two communities are only symptomatic of the effect that small everyday interactions between African Americans and Asian Americans can have on the way in which people are raised to view each other, Fang said. Well, my interjection here is that's bullshit, because niggers are fucking animals. They're dirty, they're rude, they steal, and they're toxic. And that's enough of that article. We all get the message. The good news is that the Chinks don't like the niggers, and as the Chinks slowly displace whites, which they're doing, especially on the West Coast, they're not going to have this. The Chinks don't have this this empathy and sympathy, this sympathy gene that whites have. The Chinks don't care about slavery and oppression and colonization when it comes to their own tribe. They're just going to kick these fucking niggers out. Good riddance. I'm going to play you an excerpt that's rather old. It's from 2007, and it comes from a sort of a lefty news network that's got far too many guests who receive grants from foundations and who are college professors. But there's some good information in here. And this fellow is an elderly professor who has probably since passed away, but he is a chemist, I believe, and he is discussing the Hubbard curve. And I think he was a student of Professor Hubbard in the 1950s. Now, Professor Hubbard is rather famous now for his famous diminishing returns of or rather diminishing supply of oil in ratio to the population. And the Hubbard curve also has come to include the difficulty in reaching refinable oil. And that's something we got to consider. Oil is never going to run out. There's always going to be oil down under the crust. But remember that we are drilling 10, 20,000 feet deep through thousands of feet of ocean to get to this stuff now. The easy oil is gone. The easy oil is so far gone that now we're desperately doing this very dangerous alternate carbon extraction called fracking, which is imperiling the water tables and will certainly someday toxify the water tables and kill our stupid asses anyway. So good riddance. Anyway, this is the professor. Listen in.
Little jiggle on the downhill side when the Alaska pipeline started delivering oil. It was a partial recovery. But then that production has now peaked, and everything's going downhill in unison on the right-hand side of the curve. So I became aware of his work. He spoke here at the university once, had a nice talk, and I got to know him.
Let me interject here. I should have done this at the beginning. This is Professor Albert Bartlett, and he sounds like a kindly old fellow and trustworthy, and he's at the end of his life, and he's lived his life, and I don't think he has any reason to defend big oil and the Rothschilds and BP. Continuing.
As I was lecturing around the country, one time I was lecturing in Washington, I knew he lived in Bethesda, so I phoned him and invited him to come over to hear me, which he did very kindly, and since I drew so much on his work in my lecture, at the end I introduced him to the audience, and to great applause, because he was a very far-sighted guy.
And probably better known even today than then.
I think so. The Hubbert curve is now a term in the general language, and that's happened in the last 10 or so years.
That's very interesting. And then as you were working with the question of energy, at some point you realized that an even more fundamental factor was population.
Well, first of all, before that, it came to me that public officials were making statements that were just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Things that were just totally at odds with the facts. And that many of these public officials and executives of corporations, and the corporation people, were just committed to growth. We've got to have growth. And so I began... So shifted the focus around to growth, the arithmetic of growth, and where growth gets you in terms of using up resources and so on and growing populations. And so the population thing came in rather gradually, and it became very clear that essentially all of our problems in the world today are due to overpopulation. And I like to observe that with global warming, that if any fraction of the observed global warming can be attributed to the actions of humans,
mm-hmm.
this by itself is positive proof that the human population, living as we do, has exceeded the carrying capacity of the Earth.
I've read where you've written that a couple times.
Yeah.
Can you explain that, please?
Well, you know, if there are so many of us using so much energy that we are heating the global atmosphere, that just says there are too many of us, or we're living too high on the hog. So we have to cut back either our per capita consumption, that would be an unpopular thing, or we have to reduce our population. And that, many people in this country say, would be an unpopular thing, but it's happening in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and it's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you say to people who argue that we have to have a growing population in order to pay for the retirement of people who are older?
That's a very legitimate question. It's a very real problem, but it's trivial compared to the problem of just continuing our growth of population.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Social Security system is a Ponzi scheme which is based on growth. And it works for a while as long as the growth continues, but at some point it collapses, fiscally collapses on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem with Social Security. It was based on a growing population, written back in the 1930s originally by members of Congress who apparently must not have understood the long-term implications of continued population growth. And so it has to be reworked. And, you know, the only options are reduce the benefits or increase the payroll taxes.
Well, one of the arguments supports immigration is that all these new immigrants are going to help pay for Social Security, and yet it seems that whether legally or not, if you bring a large number of young immigrants into the country, you're creating an interest group that's strongly in favor of further immigration.
Yeah.
And then, as you pointed out in various places, the higher standard of living in the U.S. Means that we're depleting resources faster than other people in other parts of the world. So if you add more people into that mix, you're getting faster global resource depletion. Why doesn't the immigration issue get cast in these limits to growth terms, do you suppose?
It's politically incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
If you say much about immigration, you're likely to be cast as a racist or something like this, and so it's a very touchy thing. I have a paper on immigration that's just in press now with negative population growth, but it's just looking at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the numbers just tell us, you know, the U.S. population today, as we are, is not sustainable, period. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot continue very long on this present path. And much of the alarm in Washington about the energy problem just reflects that. And it reflects that we're totally dependent on people who are not entirely friendly to us for our petroleum, which is the lifeblood of our country.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a very precarious position to be in.
Well, do you have an estimate of what the sensible level of population would be for the United States?
Well, you can't have a closed formula that gives you a firm number.
Okay.
Because you have, the first thing you have to plug in is, well, how well do you want to live? If we all wanted to live like people in Uganda, well, you could probably pack another couple hundred million people into the United States.
Sure.
But we don't want that. And so we would like to live well. And David Pimentel, who is a global agricultural scientist at Cornell University, he has estimated that a sustainable U.S. population based on today's U.S. average dietary level
mm-hmm.
is like half of our present population, like 120, 150 million, something like that, like the population was at the end of World War II.
And you reckon that even if we were to adopt a zero-growth population, that it would take at least 70 years to be made effective?
What happens is, and I didn't understand this till I made a model on my computer, is that if you have a growing population, because, for instance, the fertility rate is 4 children per woman, that gives you a rapid growth population. If you suddenly on the computer say, we're just from now on, we're going to only have 2 children per woman,
mm-hmm.
your first thought would be, okay, then it becomes stable. Well, it doesn't become stable until every individual has died who was living at the time the change was made. It gradually approaches stability.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a growing population and suddenly, by magic, you changed the fertility from 4 down to 2 children per woman, the curve slowly stops growing and finally levels off after about 70 years.
Wow.
And so that means the decisions we make today on population, we won't see the full effect of those for 70 years.
And yet at the same time, as you point out, the time horizon of most politicians is just, you know, 2 or 4 or 6 years or something.
No, it's a complete mismatch.
Well, taking another slice at it, maybe, in one of your papers recently, Springer Verlag, actually it looks like a nice collection, you and Mikhail Gorbachev and Herman Daly and papers from a number of really interesting people, you put out a number of laws. And your fifth law is one cannot sustain a world in which some regions have high standards of living while others have low standards of living. Could you explain that? That's a little bit confusing to me.
Well, I think that lots of the terrorism and turmoil that we see in the world today
mm-hmm.
involves the have-nots versus the haves.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as there are these different standards of living, and people know about the standards are different, why, they will be taking actions to try to equalize them. And these actions often take the form of, if things are too frustrating, then the actions become actions of terrorism. And so it's interesting that the modern technology, we've been able to make television sets and put television into even straw huts in the darkest parts of the dark continent.
Mm-hmm.
So the people know what they're missing. They see American movies. And they see all the trappings of very high standards of living, and they're living in poverty, and this is frustrating. And if they can't solve the problems, get things, their own lives equalized and higher standard of living, why, then that's their breeding ground for terrorism.
I'm not sure I see the terrorism connection, but no doubt there would be a lot of discontent. Well, take Africa though as an example to explore. A lot of people argue that the world is already past its carrying capacity. But if Africa were brought up to the same standard of living as the U.S., we'd be many times over even the carrying capacity that we've exceeded today. So
that is correct. That's the estimates. You know, there's a very nice analysis called ecological footprint analysis that was developed by Professor Bill Reese and his student Mathis Wackernagel at the University of British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
A nice little book that they wrote, Your Ecological Footprint. And they estimate that today the population, some living poor, some living very well, that our total footprint now is like 1.2 Earths.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to bring up everybody up to the present U.S. standard of living, it would take another 5 or 6 Earths.
Yeah.
And so that just emphasizes what you said a moment ago. And this then makes the problem even more difficult. You can quickly estimate that there aren't enough fossil fuels existent in the total Earth to allow the underdeveloped populations of the world to come up to our standard of living on any reasonable time scale. You couldn't do it in, you know, less maybe than 100 years. There aren't that quantity of fossil fuels around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the die is cast. So we're living in a very precarious position.
Well, it's sort of a zero-sum game. And to the extent that we're... It's a policy conundrum, too, because to the extent that we're providing aid in places like Africa, we're, in a sense, exacerbating the problem, right?
That is correct. And you have an even more difficult thing by saying all of modern medicine is making the problem worse. Because by extending lifetimes, you increase the rate of growth of population. And so what we've done is we've accepted with great eagerness the benefits of modern medicine,
mm-hmm.
without realizing that there's a responsibility that goes with that, and that is to reduce the fertility rate so that the improvements in medicine don't just yield a higher growth rate of our population.
To take another example, China. China is growing so fast, it doesn't seem possible to me that anybody could go to the Chinese government to say, well, gee whiz, you're growing too fast, you're using too many resources, slow down. So at what point does their growth start to collide with the rest of the world?
The answer is anytime. It's colliding right now. And but it's interesting. When the Chinese put in their very coercive one child per family policy about 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
their official statement of justification was words to the effect that population growth interferes with economic development. Now you look at the economic development that they have achieved in those 30 years, and you look at the fact that their population policy has cut their growth rate in half So they're still growing, but the growth rate is way down from what it would otherwise have been.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you could say that that reduction of the growth rate is one of the big sociological accomplishments in all of human history. But they're still growing. But they recognize that having population growth just interfered with economic development, so they chose economic development, and they're doing very successfully at that. Now, there's another interesting aspect to this. With all their consumption of energy, a lot of it's rather primitive, and they're burning big quantities of coal every year,
mm-hmm.
putting lots of greenhouse gas into the air, lots of contribution to global warming. But when it comes to the international agreements on what do the countries do to reduce global warming, I see reports now suggesting that they are going to these conferences and saying, look, our population policy has avoided the births of something like 300 million people. We've avoided those. And that's, by the way, that's roughly the population of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We've avoided all those births. We've avoided all the pollution that those people would contribute. So we've already made a gigantic contribution toward reduction of global warming.
That's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that at all.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. It's extremely interesting. Do you know what the response to that argument is?
I only heard it of just a few weeks ago, so I came across it somewhere, and I have not heard a response to it.
It's a pretty strong argument.
It is.
Do you happen to know what the current population growth rate in China is?
I'm sorry, I don't, but I'm going to guess it's 1.5%, something like that,
mm-hmm.
per year. And, you know, on the basis of a billion people, that's an enormous growth rate.
Yeah.
That's like 10 million a year.
So, in your mind, then the Chinese still have an incentive to cut back on their population growth?
Yeah, because it helps their economic growth. Their economic growth is now giving them leverage by which they can have enormous fiscal impact on the rest of the world. A big part of our public debt is debt to them for sending us over toys and stuff painted with lead paint and,
mm-hmm.
and various kinds of things that have been very deleterious to our health, as well as televisions and all kinds of electronic gear. And so all the money they're making off of that, they're going to be controlling a big part of the U.S. economy, because they can come back in with that money and buy up U.S. corporations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Saudis have been doing that, and some of the other Arab states have been doing that with their oil revenues. So they already own a big chunk of the U.S.
Now remember, this is 7 years ago.
It is such a serious consideration that population is going to be the kind of the ultimate limit. I guess that's your 21st law of extinction is forever.
Right.
What is your sense of how people respond to these arguments? I mean, we've got a lot of intelligent people here in the United States, maybe a few more intelligent than you, certainly plenty more intelligent than me. How come people aren't paying attention, or what's your sense of the way that people do pay attention or begin to learn about it?
Well, you know, I think there is still some trust in government. And I first encountered this after 1 year of college. I dropped out for a while, and I worked on iron ore freighters on the Great Lakes. And I was a dishwasher on the first one and a night cook on the second one.
And you took a lot of photographs when you were doing
it. I took a lot of photographs. But I used to wonder, we run up and get something like, 10,000 tons of this rich Mesabi iron ore, take it down to Buffalo, New York, throw it in the Republic Steel mill furnace,
mm-hmm.
run up and get another 10,000 tons up and down. I used to wonder, will we ever run out of this stuff? And I can remember saying to myself, don't worry, Al, you're just a dishwasher. If there's any problem, there are smart people in Washington who are looking at this, and they will sound the alarm in time for us to avoid a catastrophe. And I'm ashamed to admit how many years it was before I realized that's completely wrong. the people in Washington are not smart in that way, and they will not warn us in advance of possible real trouble. And this just goes back to my citing this report from 1974 written by Hubbard for a committee of the U.S. Senate. Everything's there, the predictions, the projections, and that should have set off alarm bells. Instead of that, why, it was just filed away, and nobody paid any attention. And I've got one. I don't know whether I sent you a copy of that paper on resources in Australia.
Yes, you did. I read it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, here is the Minister of Resources of Australia in an article in an energy magazine boasting that Australia is the largest exporter of coal in the world. And he goes on to say with great glee, we have 110 years worth at present rates of consumption, and we're growing 5% per year. When I look at the implications, the stupidity of this statement, first of all, 110 years, that should be sounding alarm bells instead of great rejoicing, because 110 years is not long compared to the life expectancy of a major industrialized nation.
Mm-hmm.
He should be sounding alarm bells, say, gee, we better save some of this for future people in Australia. Then he sticks by that 110 years and says it's growing 5% per year. Well, it's a little bit of easy arithmetic to figure out that if it's growing 5% per year and would last 110 years of present rates of production, it's going to last much shorter, down around 30 years, if you continue that 5% growth. And so what I did in that paper was you can take how long it'll last at a present rate of consumption and the present rate of growth of production and plot a plausible future scenario for the production of the resource.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those, and for instance, for those figures, it turns out that the production in the future will peak something like, I'd have to look it up, 20 or 30 years down the road. And after that, it's all downhill. There's no way you can get around that. And it would peak at something like 50% higher than the present rate of production.
Getting at what you're saying about the common sense notion that governments would want to retain some of their non-renewable resources, there's a sort of new term of art, I think, just appearing in the last year, maybe less, the idea of an export peak for oil, for example, where countries that are large exporters realize, perhaps looking at examples like Indonesia, that exporting countries are very likely going to turn into importing countries, and they ought to conserve the oil that they've got for their own uses and for future generations. How much does the idea of an export peak affect the idea of peak oil, do you think?
Well, I think that point of view is a very responsible one, to say we don't want to ship this oil off to other countries. We and our descendants in our home country, we're going to need that oil, and so let's just keep it here. And you see, this then runs counter to all the international trade agreements that have been so much discussed and so much debated. Those international trade agreements, I suspect, are motivated in part by the developed nations, such as the United States, wanting to get our hands on the resources of other countries before the people of those other countries develop to the point where they will need the resources themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so these trade agreements are just going in the wrong direction. And one of the terms you hear now in the discussion of international trade and energy is we want energy security. That is, we want guaranteed supplies so we can go on wasting energy at our present rate or a growing rate for a few years in the future. And that's what they call, you know, economic security or petroleum security. But that means that we're doing this at the expense of other countries.
Let me interject here. This XL pipeline, these tar sands, Mexico's increased production of oil, that's not going to benefit us here in North America. that's going to China because they've got a rising middle class and they can afford to pay top dollar for this oil.
And so it's a modern colonialism. The old colonialism, why the European nations sent people to distant countries to sort of take over the countries, manage the resources of the countries for the benefit of the people back home. Now we have tried to do it by these treaties and so on, and by military action, as in the case in Iraq, to go in and make sure that we have some resources that we can count on for at least a few years.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock for the Between George Kenny, host of the Electric Politics Show, and Professor Albert Bartlett, a lifetime student of peak oil and population. This comes from the December 14th, 2007 show of Electric Politics.
Still not clear, I think, to the general public, although you're starting to see more articles in the Financial Times and Wall Street Journal and other establishment publications that begin to broach the subject of peak oil. Where do you see a catalyst occurring in the near-term future to that would get people's attention about the fact that there's a certain limited quantity of oil on the planet?
Well, I suspect it'll just be a further increases in oil prices. It's $90 or $95 a barrel now, and it will certainly cross 100 early in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that as the high prices go, prices rise, and they will rise steadily. At some point, the Wall Street Journal will realize that we're dealing with a finite resource. They still, down there at the editorial board, they still worship the late Dr. Julian Simon, who essentially said the world is infinite, we can grow forever. I've got a copy of an article he wrote in the Cato Institute newsletter saying we can go on growing our population for 7 billion years. Well,
yeah,
this is just outrageous. But for some unknown reason, they seem to worship him down there in the high financial circles. And you see the same thing, sort of thing, in Forbes magazine, where they seem to think very much like Julian Simon did, that there's no limit to anything. We can grow and do anything we want. And they just, I don't know how these people by any measure of degrees and so on are people who should be thought of as highly educated, and how they can come to these conclusions just staggers me.
Well, it actually doesn't surprise me at all, because I spent too many years as a graduate student in economics at the University of Chicago, and I never finished the PhD. I was specializing in the history of economic thought, and I had a lot of problems with various people who were modelers and so forth, and on a theoretical level. But that was the doctrine, that basically resources are infinite, and that whenever anything becomes too expensive, substitutes will appear because of the magic of the market. And a corollary to that, I was always kind of surprised. Though I focused on the history of economic thought, I also studied some economic history, and the idea there about population is that, and I don't know if this is still the standard line, but it certainly was the unquestioned view in the Chicago school when I was there, that population increases are always and everywhere a good thing.
Yeah. Well, you see that clear down to the level of local chambers of commerce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've written about that.
It's one of the great tragedies of all times, and it's a destructive, very destructive tragedy. And I have recently talked with some political people who are, generating policy statements for the politicians for whom they work, and they aren't absolutely afraid of saying anything about population growth.
Well, in a sense, I mean, to draw upon what you were saying a moment ago about colonialism, and I want to emphasize here that when you say that, you're absolutely serious and you're not exaggerating at all, but to take it maybe a step further, when people are arguing in favor of population growth, in favor of all these other things, what it really is, whether consciously or unconsciously, it seems to me, you've got people arguing for the idea that some smaller group of people is going to own pretty much everything that other people use.
Yes.
And it's to their benefit to have this idea.
Well, yeah, there are winners and losers, and I remember speaking at West Point in October of 2000. Mm-hmm. I got on the plane at Newark to come back home. I just picked a magazine out of the rack, and it was Forbes, for I think it was October 2 of the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And here was a 24-page special advertising insert in that magazine saying, come to Colorado. We've got a wonderful environment. We'll destroy it any way you want it destroyed. And here are all the bankers and the big real estate people and some of the political leaders saying, we welcome you, bring your factory, bring your people. We've got a good workforce that won't unionize, and they'll work for low wages, and on and on and on. And you know, I almost had to use the barf bag.
Okay, so the good professor is an honest fellow. And we here on the ground already know that's true. I'm going to play you an excerpt from a 1988 interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, the super spook who worked with the CIA and military intelligence. And in another part of this interview that I'm not going to play for you, he admits to setting up political assassinations in foreign countries. But anyway, this is a guy you should listen to. Here he is discussing the European Age of Discovery and what these explorers, the Spanish and Portuguese and English and French, how they regarded these new lands and how they organized the lands for exploitation. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way, but how they transplanted their culture to these new lands to grow crops, to extract minerals, and so forth.
Years really don't count for much. Those were the years when they were really exploring, finding the earth they didn't even know existed, getting used to the fact that you could go to the west coast of California from England and so on, and that there was a route you could make the trip. And that took about 200 years. And by the time they got that organized, then they got themselves involved in the Napoleonic Wars of Europe, much of which had to do with this business of conquering Earth, inventorying Earth, and you're not too far from World War I, and you're not too far from World War II. In other words, what I'm saying is this cycle is not over. We haven't finished the inventory of Earth. We haven't finished who owns what. But we have defined the idea of property. Property now, right down to the last inch. There's no, the middle of Tokyo, and a square foot of ground is selling for thousands of dollars. There were sections of this that are quite interesting. I read in the newspaper not too long ago that some property in Africa had been taken from native groups, and they decided to give some of it back. And the section of that property was called the Jesuit Square. And as I recall what I read, and I wish I had the figures here, I think the Jesuit Square was about 15,000 square miles. In other words, as these missionaries moved ahead on this inventory process and just assumed ownership of this land, they were taking over so much land that 15,000 square miles was just a square, just a square. Like, what do we call a square mile? 640 acres is a square mile, about 1 mile square, isn't it? Well, this figure is the same figure that was used when the Spanish East India Company began to go into what we now call New Mexico, Arizona, and Southern California. In the old land titles, it still speaks of Jesuit Square. You see, this was a formal application of the missionary role on into these so-called unexplored countries. Everything was from the point of view of Europe. The fact that there were hundreds of thousands of people living somewhere, it was called unexplored. They just ignored the fact those people were there. It wasn't explored by British, like the discovery of America. You know, you keep saying Columbus discovered America and the British explorers and so on, the pilgrims first came to America. My God, America was overrun with people. But The Europeans discovered America. See, that's part of the overwhelming significance of this discovering that the Earth was a sphere. Now, we are living in what might be called the apex of this big curve. It certainly isn't over. We're still operating under the principles of Haileybury College, Malthus and Darwin, and even though both of them are ridiculous. It's been proved today that the food, that our ability to produce food is 70 times greater per farmer than it was in the time of Malthus. It's been proved that Darwin never did discover the origin of a species. No scientist has ever describe the origin of any species. But those two doctrines have been implanted on us by the East India Company's mind control techniques so thoroughly that we believe them. And it was in 1862 that Lord Oliphant came back from his job as ambassador to the Ottoman Empire in Turkey, imbued with the spirit that something happens to men's minds in seances. And he created in England the British Society of Psychic Research, which immediately took over most of the higher positions in government. In fact, Lord Balfour, for over 30 years, was either the head of the British Society of Psychic Research or one of his relatives or close associates was. And it's the American wing of the British Society of Psychic Research, which created Stanford University, University of Indiana. For instance, Leland Stanford, the great railroad man on the West Coast, claims that he was in a seance talking to his dead son when his dead son told him to create a major university on the West Coast, and there we have Stanford University. Well, that's kind of a humorous little story until you put it in this context, that these enormously powerful leaders stemming from the East India Company got into this psychic research arena and even began to impress upon the Society of the United States, South Africa, other parts of the world, their own beliefs in the power of seances, in the power of mind control, and things like that. And just to kind of wind this up with a little anecdote, the governor of the East India Company in Bombay, India, was a man named Elihu Yale, Eli Yale. Yale heard that a small college in New England, specifically Connecticut, was having trouble getting started. He donated something like $10,000, which was a lot of money in those days, to help found the college. And we have Yale University, comparable to Harvard University, as a function of a gift from the East India Company, from Yale in Bombay, India. In his offices in Bombay, which still exists, on the wall, there is the flag of the British East India Company. That flag has 7 red bars and 6 white bars. In the corner, it has a blue square. And in that square, or rectangle, is the emblem of the East India Company. When the Bostonians attacked the ship Dartmouth and threw the tea in Boston Harbor at the Boston Tea Party, they took the flag down off the Dartmouth. It was the East India flag with the red and white stripes and the blue rectangle, and they saved it as a memento of that battle. And when George Washington went to Boston to assume command of the armies of the rebellion against England, he asked Betsy Ross to take the emblem off the flag and to put stars. And all Betsy Ross did that night was not create a flag. She simply snipped out the East India emblem, put in 13 little white stars, and the American flag is the East India flag. And when you hear people of what you might call ancestral backgrounds in this country demanding that we pledge allegiance to the flag, you may sometimes wonder if in their seances they don't see the East India flag instead of the American flag as the driving force.
Take a note of that, that the United States flag is the Americanized version of the British East India symbol. And that spirit and momentum is still imbued in the United States' attitude towards trade and warfare.
Everyone read and study the books of Dr. Joseph Needham of Cambridge University in England. There's a whole series of books, and they're absolutely indispensable to an understanding of the true history of man on Earth. Well, one of the interesting things about Needham's work and some of the other studies of this, of the Chinese people in those days, was the Chinese had mastered the ability to sail in the oceans, as the Portuguese had later on. And the Chinese would follow the coastline down from China, down around Southeast Asia, down around Malaysia, and back up to the Burmese coast, across the Bay of Bengal to Calcutta, or down the east coast of India, past Ceylon and around the tip of India, and on up to Bombay, and even around to Arabia and East Africa. And the story goes that as the Chinese visited port cities on their trips along, it was like a party. As they pulled into port, they would stand out there and wave banners and hold gifts in their hands. They would sing songs and they would dance. They wouldn't carry firearms. And the people met them the same way. And they were welcome to stay for years or to stay whatever they wanted. And they opened up trade and sailed back and forth between these places until one day they arrived in a certain area of the east coast of Africa, and they were treated with hostility. And they found out that's as far as the Portuguese had gotten, coming around from Portugal, around Africa, and using guns every time they went ashore, burning villages, stealing whatever they wanted. And it showed that the Chinese method of exploration had been a party with official ambassadors, with presents for the local rulers and all. And the Portuguese system was to use guns and shoot the people. So we see quite a difference in these cultures. And this has led even to a better understanding of their overland exploration. The Chinese, having this enormous landmass to their west, had the same interest in exploring the west as we did, you know, wondering how far the west went. And the Chinese actually traveled with ambassadors, official people from their government, in parties of 15 or 20 as far as we understand today, like Baghdad. And there, such parties would meet the leaders of Baghdad. They would talk and understand each other. The Chinese seemed to be very adept at languages. And if they didn't know the language, they would sit down and study it and study everything these people had. And there was a very intriguing story of a party that the rulers of China sent back to Baghdad with a very learned leader and some 15 or 20 scholars with him.
Okay, this is very interesting stuff, and this could go on. It's a two-hour interview. I'm going to cut it here because it's not immediately relevant to my theme, which is white survival in North America. But you can Google this interview with Colonel Prouty, and it is probably among the top 10 interviews you can listen to educate yourself about what the United States is and what it's likely to do. Now I'm going to play for you an excerpt from a very recent interview with a fellow named Mark Deal. He was a used to be a corporate lawyer in New York, and he got into some trouble with somebody somehow, and he dropped out and ran around the world, and now he lives up in the bush in Maine. And this is a telephone interview with him. The audio on Deal's end is not real good, but I found what he had to say informative. He's talking about the corporatization of the individual by the absorption of the individual into the technology which is owned by corporations. Listen up.
I wrote it so that most of the 17 billion people in the world are not conscious. They're connected by wires in these big brain banks. They are literally the computer bank of these giant institutions. And people say, oh, well, you know, that might not happen. You can't have that. But that's, you know, is that really that different than having a cell phone? phone to your head 24/7? You know, now we're getting texts, we're getting email, we're getting all of these work-related communications constantly, 24 hours a day, all the time. We're working, we're plugged in. So I think the natural state is becoming one where we're constantly at work.
And you throw in the rise of all the social media with these, you know, technology, with the smartphones, the iPads, the iTouches, the Kindles, and all these different things, the social media, the instant gratification, and it literally does put us in this mode where we have a large group of people that are always plugged in or tuned in, if you will, to the World Wide Web, to these social media programs, emails, or whatever, or what have you. Mark, what do you think about ways for us as individuals, listeners right now, you and I mean, I think we can see this in so many different ways, the rise of kind of the corporate species of man. For individuals, what do you think about, you know, I'm a big advocate of empowering ourselves and walking away from things that don't resonate with us. When we tie in the rise of the corporate species of man with technology, what should we as individuals be doing, or what do you think we should be wary of ourselves as far as technology in the coming days?
I think actually that's an interesting question, and I've thought about it like this. You know, this pattern of concentrating power, you know, you see it throughout nature and things. It's happened before. It happened when individual cells got together and formed multicellular organisms. You know, and if you think about it, that was the technology. You know, the ability to link these cells together the same way that now we have these devices linking us together. And so you have a multicellular organism, and then you have these individuals. And what are these individuals in the microbiology world? Well, they're parasites. They're parasites to the big organism that is those multi-celled, that, you know, the individual is something like an amoeba. The corporate would be something like a cheek cell, a liver cell, a nerve cell. So they're highly specialized, and they're part of this giant organism, and they can't survive on their own. So individuality becomes parasitism. And people say, well, okay, well, what does that mean if we're all corporate? If the new entity, the new body becomes the corporation or the government, what does that make the individual then? Well, it makes the individual a parasite. And what is that parasite? Well, crime is parasitic. So if we have a world where all the resources are legally owned by corporations, what's left to the individual? Well, we'll have to be criminal. That's how we survive as an individual, is we're outside of that body. We're fighting for our survival. And then you start to see, okay, well, so the corporation, the government, they have their structures to defend against that. They have an immune system. And that's your police. That's your military.
Right. And I find it interesting, Mark. I'm thinking back last Sunday, covered a piece about Aldous Huxley, Brave New World Revisited, a piece he did in the late 1950s. And he talked about in the future, it literally will be possible to have a majority of people who will be living in abnormal circumstances, but because all of it will be created through social engineering, medicine, or what have you, the majority of people will be living in abnormal circumstances or be living abnormal lifestyles, but because the majority of people are living that way, it will then be deemed normal. So what he was predicting is that we will literally have a major or a large percentage of people living an abnormal life, but because so many of them do that, that is now the new normal. Do you see any similarities with the predictions of Huxley and with the direction you're going with your book, 17?
Oh, sure. And I think we see that now. You know, it is not a normal life to sit in front of a computer screen for, you know, 20 hours a day like people are doing now. It's not a normal, natural way to live, to eat genetically engineered food or food-like products that come out of these packages that most of it is not, you know, that, that our grandparents wouldn't recognize as food. You know, so I think that's already happening. And in 17, I have, the food is totally synthesized because they've made plants illegal. Because you can't, if it's a natural plant, you can't patent it. But if you genetically engineer it, you can patent it. What's the difference? Well, if it's a patented product, a company can make money off of it without actually providing it to you. They don't just own the right to distribute you, to you this product. They own your right to consume it. So if everything in the future is has to be synthesized by bacteria or by genetically modified organisms, all natural plants have to be illegal. And there's your force behind owning the government. These corporations can push that through.
Well, it's an incredible story. 17, folks. Mark Diehl, armyofthedoomed.com. That's armyofthedoomed.com. Mark, thank you so much for taking time out of your night, and keep warm out there, folks.
So that'll do it for today, resistors. This is DC Scout signing out. And remember, don't trust anybody on a government pension, and never, ever trust a Jew. 88.
Well, thank you, DC Scout. Thank you very much. That's a lot to get your head wrapped around, get your brain wrapped around. I was just thinking there when he said that the Chinese had been able to limit their population by 300 million. It's interesting. Is it a plan of predatory capitalism, or is it a byproduct of predatory capitalism that by feeding the industrial growth of China has led to the direct loss of 300 million people? Isn't that interesting how that cycle comes around? But the problem is that with unfettered controls on industrialization, they're eating up massive amounts of carbon, and they're spilling massive amounts into the atmosphere. So just by limiting the population by 300 million, on the other end, is adding to the pollution. So you can't win for losing. One thing they say all the time is like Columbus discovered America and all that kind of stuff, and they poo-poo it. Well, I think what in reality they meant was Columbus discovered America for Europeans, and wherever they went, they discovered these lands. Not that they didn't know there were a lot of people there, but they, in their defense, they were discovering things for their people in the European, on the European continent, and that's what they meant. For at least that's the way I think. But they're always saying that, oh well, it was discovered and people were all over the place. Okay, well, I got a lot of things I could comment on here, but we'll wait till next time. In the meantime, encourage other people to sign up and become subscribers to this radio show, because you can see that you're not getting right wing stuff, you're not getting Jew left stuff. We concentrate on the things that are most important, and you're not seeing any promotion of parades and so forth on this show. I think it needs to get out to a lot more of more white people that have ears to hear and eyes to see. 14:05, I'll be back with you tomorrow, and tomorrow is... I lose all track of time. Yeah, this is Thursday. I'll be back with you on Freya's Day. That's Ladies' Day.
I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh. I went to sleep in Detroit City, and I dreamed about those cotton fields and home. I dreamed about my mother, dear old papa, sister, and brother. I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting for so long. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Oh, how I wanna go home. Home folks think I'm big in Detroit City. From the letters that I write, they think I'm fine. But by day I make the cards, by night I make the bars. If only they could read between the lines. 'Cause you know, I rode a freight train north to Detroit City. And after all these years, I find I've just been wasting my time. So I just think I'll take my foolish pride and put it on a southbound freight and ride. Go on back to the loved ones, the ones that I left waiting so far behind. I wanna go home. I wanna go home.